I would like to talk to you during my presentation about European Investigation Order. Maybe for those of you who are might not be too familiar with the text of the directive, I can mention you that in the documentation you will find one of the files. I think it's called Hyperlink Background Documentation. It's a PDF with lots of information and links, and I believe it's on page 3, you will find the link to the directive. So a lot of the things that I will be talking about during my presentation, you can of course find in the directive itself. So let's have a look at the European Investigation Order directive, because as Laviero mentioned, it is the law as it is today. We have to work with what we have for this time. So I will not be talking about coming law, which was done yesterday for a bit. Unfortunately, I was not able to follow all seminars yesterday. I was able to follow one seminar by my colleague from Luxembourg, Tasso, which was a very interesting seminar. And I noticed that he already mentioned a couple of things I will be mentioning today, but that's not a big deal. What I will not do is talk about the production order, for example. Let's keep it for now for the European Investigation Order. Maybe as an introduction, I would like to mention that as far as historical background, of course, and this was mentioned yesterday as well, why do we need, why did we need the directive, and why did we, or do we need special measures for electronic evidence? This, of course, all has to do with what happened in the past. We used to work with mutual legal assistance instruments, such as the instrument of 2000 in the UA, the European Union, the Convention on Mutual Assistance in Criminal Matters. But as you all know, of course, this has a lot of complexities to it, especially when we're talking about electronic evidence. There are a lot of challenges with the use of mutual legal assistance, such as the fact that it's very hard to get timely responses, that there are a lot of formalities, it takes a lot of time, and it's very complicated and technical to use. I must say that in the past, when even before the directive that we're talking about today, when we were obliged to use mutual legal assistance, there were some creative prosecutors and judges who were trying to find workarounds to avoid mutual legal assistance. So, for example, the Belgian cases of Yahoo and Skype are worth mentioning, of course. And as a matter of fact, my colleague Tosa talked about it yesterday. So those were two cases. Maybe I'll delve a little bit into detail in one of them, the first one, which was the Yahoo case, because it was mentioned yesterday that this was being done by or initiated by an investigative judge or juge d'instruction. Maybe a little, a very tiny correction. It was a prosecutor. It was a Belgian prosecutor who was being creative at that time, and he was using one of the articles in the Belgian Code of Criminal Procedure, which is Article 46 bis in the code. He was using that article to ask Yahoo, the Yahoo firm at that time, to give some information about the identity of a user of email who was using the Yahoo platform to send emails to other or to victims in Belgium. And so the specific thing about this case is that Article 46 obliges system obliges the system providers to cooperate and obliges them to furnish information if it is asked by the Belgian prosecutor. Of course, the whole discussion was, is Yahoo a system provided? That was the first question. I must say that there were a lot of procedures in this case, and this case went two times to the Belgian Court of Cassation, which is a Supreme Court in Belgium. So one of the first questions was the question whether Yahoo is a system provider as meant in that specific article in the Belgian Code of Criminal Procedure. Eventually, the Belgian Supreme Court, Court of Cassation, said that this is the case, so they had to work with the Belgian prosecutor. But then, of course, as it was mentioned yesterday, there were other legal discussions that had to be solved. But eventually, Yahoo indeed was convicted in Belgium for not cooperating with the Belgian prosecutor. And we had a second case, which was the Skype case as well. And in that case, Skype was also convicted in Belgium. So what we can learn from these cases is that it's, of course, very complex. We could ask for ourselves, why did the Belgian prosecutor do this? Why did he try something that was completely new? And why didn't he just use mutual legal assistance, which was the common way to get the information that he wanted to get? Well, it all comes down, of course, to the same same thing, because the mutual legal assistance wouldn't help him in his case. It was for him impossible to use mutual legal assistance because it would take too long, it was too hard. Of course, it was possible technically, he could use mutual legal assistance, but he chose not to do so because he wanted to try another solution, to be creative, and it worked for him in that case. Well, you might say it worked. Well, it didn't actually. In his case, it did not work because he had to wait several years to get the decision. And the decision was only a conviction of Yahoo, which is, of course, something different than to get the information that he needed. But this all shows that even before the directive and even before the instruments we are waiting for now to get things done with electronic evidence, it shows that it's difficult for prosecutors, for judges, and that there are reasons for them to try to find other solutions, such as this Belgian prosecutor tried in Belgium. And yes, this all workarounds to avoid mutual legal assistance because of all the disadvantages of MLA. So at that time in 2014, the directive of April 3rd was a bit of a solution that many hoped for. Many hoped that with the introduction of that directive, there would be a better situation for evidence in general, but also for electronic evidence. As you know, European investigation order, just to give a very quick definition, is a judicial decision to have specific investigative measures carried out in another member state with the objective to obtain evidence in general, but also, of course, electronic evidence could be gathered using this directive. I must say that the directive was a bit of a pickle when it was proposed in 2010, which was at the end of the Belgian presidency, as a matter of fact. It was supported by a limited number of EU member states. Of course, Belgium was one of those, but it was a rather limited number. And there was a lot of discussion also going on between the member states regarding this directive at that time. It's also indicative that the implementation took a long time. So 3 years is a rather long time. So it was implemented it should have been implemented by the different member states by the 22nd May of 2017, which was the case in most of the member states. Actually, Belgium was one day short. It was published in the official Gazette on the 23rd of May, but it entered into force the 22nd. That's typical Belgium, of course. So they managed to get the deadline, but actually it was published one day later. I must say, though, that the directive, that's an important point, of course, is not... most of the member states, of course, are bound by the directive, but there are there are some exceptions, which is Ireland and Denmark, recently also the United Kingdom. This, of course, has to do with Brexit, and because of Brexit, recently the directive or the UK is no longer bound by the directive. And maybe some of you noticed that the UK Supreme Court has also dealt with issues regarding procedural law after Brexit in a decision of February 5th of this year. So what I would like to do the next half hour is to delve into the directive, just make some general remarks about the directive, just to freshen things up for you all. Again, of course, you can look into the text of the directive, which you find in the document. So, maybe first some basic information about the Directive of 2014. So as I mentioned before, we're dealing with a judicial decision which can be described, as I mentioned earlier. Okay, so the European investigation order can be described as a single standardized order for all types of evidence in general, so not only electronic evidence but all types of evidence. Actually, there are two exceptions to that rule, because the setting up of or gathering evidence within joint investigation teams and cross-border surveillance provided for in the conventions implementing the Schengen Agreement is not a possible measure for the European Investigation Order. As you know, of course, the European Investigation Order is based on mutual recognition, with orders circulating between and executed by competent authorities with a number of non-mandatory grounds for refusal, which I will be mentioning a bit further on. So the European Union has, as Laviero mentioned in his introduction, found a bit of inspiration in other previous instruments, with European arrest warrant, as mentioned by Laviero, as being one of the big examples. Of course, it's also an instrument that has been working for a very long time now. It's very probably one of the most successful instruments in that regard. So, as you can see, it is an instrument that is applicable to any investigative measure, which is mentioned in Article 3 of the directive. This, of course, includes the gathering of electronic evidence as well. There are some specific provisions in the directive concerning types of electronic evidence. So, for example, you can read about specific provisions on the interception of telecommunications in Article 30 of the directive. You can also read in Article 10 about specific provisions about the identification of a person holding IP addresses or telephone numbers. Just like take a look, let's take a look as a reminder or to freshen things up a bit at the procedure being followed when using an investigation order. So as you probably know, an investigation order may be issued by judges, courts, investigating judges, and public prosecutors. This is mentioned, of course, in the directive. It can be issued by them if the national law entitles them, of course, to do that, or it can also be done by any competent authority, as mentioned as well in the directive. It's also mentioned, by the way, in the directive that if national defense rights so permit, the issuing of an European investigation order may be requested by an accused person or a suspect. So this is depends on national law, whether it permits accused persons or suspects to do so. Of course, there are various conditions for issuing an investigation order. For example, the investigation has to be necessary, proportionate to the purposes of the proceedings in question. The measure also must be available in the issuing state and ordered under the same conditions as would be necessary to its issuance in a similar domestic case. Maybe it's worth mentioning that in the context of interception of telecommunication, because we're talking about electronic evidence, which is also, of course, electronic evidence, the directive requires the issuing authority to indicate the reasons why it considers the indicated investigative measure relevant for the purpose of the criminal proceedings concerned. Further about the procedure, you can read about it in Articles 5 and 6 and also 7 of the directive. And so you will see that national requests are being prepared and judicially approved based on individual national standards and rules. One has to work with particular forms. There are some content requirements, as mentioned in Article 5 and also in Annex A of the directive. It's also worth mentioning that there has to be a translation of the European investigation warrant in the language of the executing state, or one of the languages of the executing state, if there are different languages, such as is the case for Belgium. The investigation order is then sent directly to the relevant judicial authority in the relevant country, which you will find in Article 7. This can be done on various ways. It can be done by any means capable of producing a written record to guarantee authenticity, or it can be done via telecommunications systems of the European judicial network. And it's also worth mentioning that maybe in the future it will be possible to use the e-codex. As a matter of fact, recently, I believe it was on the 2nd of December 2020, the European Commission adopted the e-codex regulation. So this is something we will have to look into in the near future. So the European investigation order is then examined by the receiving and eventually executing judicial authority, which will, of course, have to verify whether there exists one of the of one or more of the grounds of refusal, which are all mentioned in the directive in Article 11, sorry, to be precise. There are a lot of possibilities there, for example, immunity or privilege or rules on determination and limitation of criminal liability. Also issues of national security interest, nebis in idem or nonbis in idem, fundamental rights, pickup, and as you can see in Article 11. Then maybe some of the grounds of refusal are important in a cyber context. For example, the dual criminality exception and the fundamental rights exception. In principle, the executing state may not refuse a European investigation order because it would not have been authorized in a similar domestic case. But I must say, however, that this ground is available exceptionally for interception of telecommunications. It's also worth mentioning that before invoking one of the refusal grounds, the European investigation order obliges, the directive obliges the executing authority to enter into dialogue with the issuing authority, including potentially requesting additional information. However, there are exceptions to this, for example, when the investigation order is refused on the grounds of lack of double criminality. As you can see, there's also the fundamental rights exception. So this may also be an issue for one of the states, for example, when it comes to encryption and the right to self-incrimination or the right to silence might be one of the issues that different states are dealing with differently at this time when it comes to the obligation to cooperate as a suspect with encryption. Maybe also interesting about the execution of the investigation order is the fact that it is possible for the executing states to execute the order, but to use different types of investigative measures, as it's mentioned in Article 10. So as you can see on the slide. So Article 10 makes it possible for the executing state to choose a different measure to execute in certain situations. So this will be the case, for example, when the alternative measure is less intrusive and may achieve the same result. It's also the case if the requested measure is not available at all or would not be available in a similar domestic case. Nonetheless, some specific investigative measures always have to be available under the law of the executing states. For example, the identification of persons holding a subscription of a specified phone number or address, IP address, is something that every state should be able to do. Eventually, the evidence will be sent back to the executing judicial authority, which you can read about in Article 13. And when it comes to the costs, you can read about that in Article 21 of the directive. Normally, those are borne by the executing state, but there might be exceptions to that, especially when the costs are exceptionally high. There is a possibility to share costs between the states. What's, of course, very important is the timeframe. Timeframe normally is 120 days, and this was mentioned yesterday as well in one of the sessions. normally 120 days. Of course, that in itself is a very long time. But still, there are many possibilities that will lead to even a longer period than 120 days. So normally we're talking about 120, which is divided between 30 days for the member states to decide to accept the requests, so to check for refusal grounds, amongst other things, and then a second period of 90 days to execute requested investigative measures. There might be some exceptions, for example, when it's very urgent, but as I mentioned, it can also be the case that there is a prolonged time frame because of several options in that regard that you can find in the directive in the articles that you can see here on the slide. So, for example, if there are reasons to for suspension or postponement, for example, when there are conflicts with ongoing cases in the executing states, it can be a reason for postponement. Maybe a quick word then about some specific regimes. You can find some specific regimes in chapter 4 of the directive. And maybe specifically when we're talking about electronic evidence, it's worth mentioning that articles 30 and 31 are relevant regarding the interception of telecommunications. So there are some important aspects about interception of telecommunications in those articles. For example, the possibility to request decoding or decrypting of the recording, which is, by the way, not an obligation. It's just a possibility. Also, the fact that the member states will be notified, member states where the subject of the interception is located, it will be notified even when there is no technical assistance needed from those member states. This is all very clearly set out in articles 30 and 31 of the directive.